The Guiding Star, to a Higher Spiritual Condition. Sequel number 2 to Rending the Veil. Produced in the same way and by means of the same combined mediumship by W. W. Abba and J. H. Nixon, 1905. By Philip Nadek. The Guiding Star: Evolutionary Immortality Triumphing as the Missing Link of Evolution, or Evolutionary Teleology. That is, evolution of immortalized sentient beings and of an appropriate realm of spirit for their habitation, the end that nature had in view from the beginning of swirling fire mist into planetary form. An open letter, in two parts, dictated by the Star Circle of Spirits for consideration of physical science, philosophy, speculative thought, metaphysics and theism. Part I of said letter being written by the spirit Wesley Abba, as amanuensis at seances 16, 17, I 8, I 9 and 25, and made the general introduction to this book. Sec. I 59, part 2 of said letter, written by the spirit Professor Michael Faraday, as amanuensis for said star circle, at seances 55, 57, 58, 62, 64 and 76, as the conclusion of the whole matter, and placed at close of this volume, and the scientist, philosopher, metaphysician, theologian and person of speculative thought are invited, first, to read carefully and to consider thoroughly, both parts of said open letter. To Philip Nadek, our friend and benefactor, to whose unselfishness we are indebted for means to place this work before the world, this volume is lovingly dedicated by the Band of Spirits instrumental in its production. This publication being the third of a series, Rending the Veil, Beyond the Veil, and The Guiding Star, it is presumed that the readers of this have read the two former, and will readily discern that the three books were produced in very nearly the same way, hence explanation given in the first and second books need not be repeated in this book, except to a limited extent. But the reader will find that he or she is kept in connection with such similar, corroborative and explanatory matter as thought desirable by appropriate references, and a liberal use of the index of each book. For such purpose, the reader will readily observe that the three volumes are fairly well paragraphed, and the paragraphs of each consecutively numbered by the appropriate figures placed in the left margin at the beginning of the paragraph, and that frequently, paragraphs have subdivisions marked by letters of the alphabet, and that references are made to paragraphs, subdivisions and pages, by the appropriate symbols placed in parentheses. For further convenience, some abbreviations are used, such as R. V. For Rending the Veil, B. V. For Beyond the Veil, G. S. For the Guiding Star, PA. For paragraph, and where page is meant. The word page is spelled in full. The vinculum is sometimes used, denoting the elliptical words, from, to, inclusive. Examples of references are V. Page 4, means, see page 4 of Rending the Veil. But in the references, where paragraph is meant, only the number of the paragraph is used, as thus, B. V. 36, signifying, see paragraph 36 of Beyond the Veil. There may be a few errors, both clerical and typographical, in references and indices, and it is true that neither references nor indices are at all full and complete, for the reason that so compactly did the spirits write and speak generally, that it would require a repetition of almost every sentence to make full index. As to distinction between words of the secretary and those of spirits, words, remarks, descriptions and observations of the secretary in this book, except headings and where directly specified, are set off by brackets and in solid type, while the words, sayings, typewritings and manuscripts of spirits are left clear of mark, and generally specified. In the former books we tried to keep this distinction clear by quotation marks, but it seems that some readers fail to discern the distinction so made. As to repetitions and cumulative evidences of authentication, some readers may criticize. In fact, some objection to cumulative matter of facts contained in Rending the Veil, have reached us even from London, eng. To much record of fact, too much pains taken in verifying and authenticating the facts. Not every scientist would urge such objection, and while one person might do so, 100 others are not satisfied without more and more, again and again. For instance, as often as it is repeated in the two former books, that the writing, speaking, picture making were always done by some spirit in visible form while standing before and in sight and hearing of the whole circle, some persons, who say they have read these accounts, still ask us, why, could you see the spectre? Could you hear it talk? Could you see it write? Could you see it while it was making a picture? A remark, further, concerning this matter may be pardoned by most minds. The observant reader will have noticed that while there seems much repetition of similar matter and phenomena, yet, no two occurrences are exactly alike, that there is continual variation of detail, that very generally, the different séances were not composed entirely of the same persons, as the records show, but that persons from widely separated homes were visitors, from time to time, and may be consulted as to authenticity of the phenomena. These visiting persons, to the number of nearly 100, have left their names and addresses, and consented that they may be used in authentication of phenomena recorded in this book in connection with their names, and these names may be found just preceding the index. After having read this book, all of it, the reader will do well to turn to the summary of the Spirit Denton in his Oration No. 51, pages 382 and 383 of Rending the Veil, and to the Syllogism of the Spirit, Professor Faraday. Something historical of the mediumship for the production of these books might be expected here, but, perhaps, we only need to say, now, that the band of spirits having charge of this work, finally succeeded in getting together and combining the phases of two mediums, one for materialization, and the other for giving out mental aura for forms through which intellectual spirits could, more or less perfectly, express their own mentality for the benefit of human beings in the physical life. Open Letter. Part I, General Introduction, written by the Spirit Wesley Abbot. The apparent futility that has attended all efforts to prove the immortality of man springs largely from the fact that a sense of immortality is an achievement in morals, and not an inference drawn by logical processes from the nature of things. It is not a demonstration to, or by the reason, but a conviction gained through the spirit in the process of human life. All truth is an achievement. If you would have it at its full value, go win it. If there is any truth whose value lies in a moral process, it must be sought by that process. Other avenues will prove hard and uncertain, and will stop short of the goal. Eternal wisdom seems to say, if you would find immortal life, seek it in human life, look neither to the heavens nor the earth, but in your own heart as it fulfills the duty of present existence. You are not mere minds for seeing and hearing truth, but beings, set in a real world to achieve it. This is the secret of creation. But if demonstration cannot yield a full sense of immortality, it does not follow that discussion and evidence are without value. Mind auxiliary to spirit, and intellectual conviction may help moral belief. 2. Doubts may be so heavy as to cease to be incentives, and become burdens. If you discover any hints of immortality in the world, or in the nature of man, you must welcome them. If there are denials of it that lose their force under inspection, you must clear your minds of them, for so you shall be freer to work out the only demonstration that will satisfy you. 3. Whatever is here said upon this subject has for its end, not only demonstration, but a clearing and paving of the way to that demonstration, which only can be realized by personal experience. Or we might say, our object is to make an open and hospitable place for it in the domain of thought. This result would be nearly gained if it were understood how the idea of immortality came into the world. 4. It cannot be linked with the early superstitions that sprang out of the childhood of the race with fetichism and polytheism and image worship, nor is it akin to the early thought that personified and dramatized the forces of nature, and so built up the great mythologies. These were the first shrewd efforts of man to find a cause for things, and to connect it with themselves in ways of worship and propitiation. But the idea of immortality had no such genesis. It is a late comer into the world. Men worshipped and propitiated long before they attained to a clear conception of a future life. A forecasting shadow of it may have hung over the early races, A voice not fully articulate may have uttered some syllable of it, and gained at last expression in theories of metempsychosis and visions of nirvana. 5. But the doctrine of personal immortality belongs to a later age. It grew into the consciousness of the world with the growth of man, slowly and late, and marked in its advent the stage of human history when man began to recognize the dignity of his nature. It does not belong to the childhood of the race, nor can it be classed with the dreams and guesses in which ignorance sought refuge, nor with the superstitions through which men strove to ally themselves with nature and its powers. It belongs to them neither in its history nor in its nature. It came with the full consciousness of selfhood, and is the product of man's full and ripe thought. It is not only not allied with the early superstitions, but is the reversal of them. These, in their last analysis, confessed man's subjection to nature and its powers, and shaped themselves into forms of expiation and propitiation. They implied a low and feeble sense of his nature, and turned on his condition, rather than on his nature, in a sense of the external world, and not on a perception of himself. 6. The assertion of immortality is an acknowledgement of nature's forces. This fact should not only separate it from the superstition, where, of late, there has been a tendency to rank it, but secure for it a large and generous place in the world of speculative thought. We should hesitate before we contradict the conviction of any age that wears these signs of development, nor should we treat lightly any lofty assertions that man may make of himself, especially when those assertions link themselves with truths of well-being and evident duty. 7. The idea of immortality thus achieved naturally allies itself to religion, for a high conception of humanity is, itself, religion. It built itself into formulations of Christianity, and became, also, its atmosphere, its main postulate, its acknowledged working factor and its ultimate hope. It is of one substance with Christianity, having the same conception of man. It runs along with every duty and doctrine, tallying at every point. It is the inspiration of the system. Each names itself by one synonym, life. Lodged, thus, in the convictions of the civilized world, the doctrine of immortality met with no serious resistance until it encountered modern science. 8. It may have been weakened and obscured in the feature of personality by pantheistic conceptions that have prevailed from time to time, but pantheism never will prevail in a hurtful degree so long as it stands face to face with the freedom of your Western civilization. A slight infusion of it is wholesome and necessary to correct an excessive doctrine of individualism, and to perfect the conception of God, and it has never gone far enough in its one line to impair the substantial validity of the doctrine of immortality. 9. But when modern science, led by the principle of induction, transferred the thought of men from speculation to the physical world, and said, "Now get at facts, and find out what your six senses reveal to you," then, immortality will no longer be under question, because science would find no place for it. Science, as such, deals only with gases, fluids and solids, with length, breadth and thickness. In such a domain, and amongst such phenomena, no hint, even, of future existence can be found, and science could only say, "I find no report of it." 10. We do not refer more to the scientific class than to a scientific habit of thought that diffused itself throughout society, and became general by that sure and gracious contagion through which men are led to think together, and move in battalions of thought, for so, only, can the powers of darkness be driven out. We do not, today, regret that science held itself so rigidly to its field and its principles of induction, that it refused to leap chasms, and to let in guesses for the sake of morals. If it held to its path somewhat narrowly, it still went safely and firmly, and left no gaps in the mighty argument it is framing, and will yet perfect. The severity, and even bigotry, that attended its early stages, even with its occasional apparent damage to morals, were the best preparation for the thoroughness of its future work. If its leaders, moved by their conviction that all truth is linked together, at times forsook the fields of the three dimensions, and spoke hastily of what might not lie beyond it, they are easily forgiven. 11. When scientists and metaphysicians are found in each other's camps, They are not to be regarded as intruders, even if they have not learned the password, but, rather, as visitors from another corps of the Grand Army. The sappers and miners may undervalue the flying artillery, and the cavalry may gird at the builders of earthworks, but as the campaign goes on, each will come to recognize the value of the other, and perhaps, in some dark night of defeat when the forces of the common enemy are pressing them in the rear, they will welcome the skill of those who can throw a bridge across the fatal river in the front, to the unseen shore beyond. 12. But science has its phases and its progress. It held itself to its prescribed task of searching matter until it eluded its touch in the form of simple force, leaving it, so to speak, empty-handed. It has got a little deeper into the heavens with its lenses, and gone a little farther into matter with its retorts, but it has come no nearer to the nature of things than it was at the outset. You may cleave a rock once and have no proper explanation of it, but you know as little when you have cleaved it a thousand times and fused it in flame. In these researches of science, many useful facts have been passed over to man, so that easier answers are given to the questions: what shall you eat and how shall you be clothed? What is the meaning of the world? Explain to me what sort of being you are, and how you came to be, what you are and for what end. Such are the questions that men are forever repeating to themselves, and casting upon their wise for possible answer. 13. When chemistry put the key of the physical universe into the hand of science, it was well enough to give up a century to the dazzling picture it revealed. A century of concentrated and universal gaze at the world, out of whose dust you are made, and whose forces play in the throbs of your hearts, is not too much, but after having sat so long before the brilliant play of elemental flames, and seen yourselves reduced to simple gas and force, under laws for whose strength adamant is no measure, you have become a little restive and taken up again the old questions. Now you have been shown of what you are made, physically, how you are put together, and how linked your actions to the invariable energy of the universe. But science has not explained you to yourselves, nor compassed you in its retort, nor measured you in its law of continuity. Hence, you still demand, explain to us consciousness, will, thought, desire, love, veneration. 14. Science in its early and usually narrow sense, could not respond to these demands. But it has enlarged its vocation under two impulses. It has pushed its researches, until it has reached verges, beyond which it cannot go. Yet it sees forces and phenomena that it cannot explain, nor even speak of, without using the nomenclature of metaphysics. In recent investigations they have adopted the word spirit into the scientific vocabulary. 15. Again, physical science has yielded to the necessity of allying itself with other sciences, finding itself on their borders. 16. Chemistry led up to biology, and this in turn to psychology, and this to sociology, history and religion, and so on to metaphysics, whose tools it had used with some disdain of their source. 17. In short, there is no such thing as a specific science, but all sciences are parts of one universal science. 18. The chemist sits down by the metaphysician and says, "Tell me what you know about consciousness." The theologian listens eagerly to the story of evolution. Unless you greatly misread the temper of recent science, it is ready to pass over certain phenomena it has discovered, and questions it has raised, to theology. And with more confidence, we may assert that theology is parting with the conceit it had assumed as queen of sciences, and clothing itself with its proper humility, is ready to accept a report from any who can aid it in its proper studies. 19. Whatever is true in one, must be true in all. Whatever is necessary to the perfection of one cannot be ruled out of another. That which is true in man's spiritual life must be true in his social life, and whatever is true in social life must not contradict anything in his physical life. We might reverse this, and say that no true physiologist will define the physical man so as to exclude the social man, nor will he so define the social and political man as to shut out the spiritual man, nor will he so define the common humanity as to exclude personality. 20. If, for example, immortality is a necessary coordinate of man's moral nature, an evident part of its content, The chemist and physiologist will not set it aside because they find no report of it in their fields. If it is a part of spiritual and moral science, it cannot be rejected because it is not found in physical science. 21. So much, at last, has been gained by the new comity in the sciences, that opinions are respected, and questions that belong to other departments are relegated to them in a scientific spirit. But the negative attitude of natural science toward immortality does not, by any means, describe its relation to the great doctrine. The very breadth of its studies has made it humble and tolerant of hypotheses in other fields. It is parting with a narrow and confining position, and is keenly alive to the analogies and sweep of the great truths it has discovered, truths which, as sciences, it cannot handle. More than this, my friends, while it has taught you to distrust immortality, because it could show you no appearance of it, it has provided you with a broader principle that undoes its works common, namely, the principle of reversing appearances. 22. The whole work of natural science might be described under this phrase: it has laid hold of the physical universe, and shown that the reality is unlike that which first appears. It has, thus, bred a fine wholesome skepticism which is the basis of true knowledge and progress. Once men said, "This is as it appears," today they say, "The reality is not according to first appearances, but is, probably, the reverse. The sky seems solid, the sun seems to move, the earth seems to be at rest, and to be flat. Science has reversed these appearances and beliefs. Matter seems to be solid and at rest, it is shown to be the contrary. The energy of an active agent seems to end with disorganization, but it really passes into another form. So it is throughout. The appearances in nature are nearly always, not false, but elusive, and our first interpretations of natural phenomena usually are the reverse of the reality. Of course, this must be so. It is the wisdom of creation, the secret of the world, else knowledge would be immediate and without process, and man a mere eye for seeing. 23. Nature puts the reality at a distance and hides it behind a veil, and it is the office of mind, in relation to matter, to penetrate the distance and get behind the veil, and to make the process valuable in the highest degree. This feature of contrariety is put into nature. What greater achievement has mind wrought than to turn the solid heavens into empty space, and fix the moving sun in the heavens, and round the flat world into a sphere? Truth is always an achievement, and it becomes such by reversing appearances, turning rest into motion, solids into fluids, centers into orbits, breaking up enclosing firmaments into infinite space. 24. The human mind tends to rest in the first appearance. Science, more than any other teacher, tells it that it may not. But it is this premature confidence in first appearance that induces skepticism of immortality. No one wishes to doubt it, our inmost soul pleads for it, our highest nature disdains a denial of it as ignoble. No poet, no lofty thinker suffers the eclipse of it to fall upon his page. But, many a poet and thinker is, nay, are we not all tormented by a horrible uncertainty, cast by the appearance of dissolving nature, and reinforced by the blank silence of science? The heavens are empty, the earth is resolving back to fire mist. What theatre is there for living man? Thought and emotion are made one with the force of the universe, shut up, for a while, in a fleeting organism. What is there besides it? Brought together out of nature, sinking back into nature, has man any other history? What, also, is so absolute in its appearance as death? 25. How speechless the speaking lips! How sightless the seeing eye! How still the no longer moving form! Touch the old hand, cry to the ear, crown the brow with weed or with flower, they are alike to it. It is an awful appearance. Say what you will, here is the scourge of the age. Science has helped to create it, but it also has discovered its antidote. 26. The minister of faith stands by this horrible appearance and says, "Not here, but arisen." He might well be joined by the priest of science with words like these: "My vocation is to wrest truth out of elusive appearances. I do not find what you claim, I find, instead, an appearance of the contrary." But, on that very principle you may be right, the truth is, generally, The reverse of the appearance. 27. We do not advance this as an argument, but to create an atmosphere for argument. You have not yet learned the secret of the world, the order of truth inverting the landscape in the lens of the eye that the mind may get a true picture. To break away from the appearance of death, this is the imperative need, and whatever science may say in detail, its larger word and also its method justify you in the effort. Hence, the need of spiritual unfoldment and nobler thought. 28. We pass now to more positive ground, speaking still of science, for the antagonist of immortality is not science, but a contagion or filtration from science that permeates common thought. Assuming evolution, it matters not now what form of it, except the extremist, which is not worthy of the name of science, we remark that the process of development creates a skepticism at every stage of its progress so great that one has no occasion even to hesitate when the claim of immortality is made. Doubt has so often broken down, that it is no longer wise to doubt. Improbability has so often given way to certainty and fact that it becomes almost a basis of expectation. Take your stand at any stage of evolution, and the next step is no stranger, no more to be anticipated. It is no broader leap than that from death to future life. Plant yourself at any given stage, with the knowledge then given off by phenomena, and report what you can see ahead. Go back to the time when the swirl of fire mist was drawing into spheres and predict future life semicolon the raging elements laugh you to scorn. Life from fire exclamation mark no dream of metempsychosis is so wild as that. You detect a law of progress, but to what are you now listening question mark to the elements or to mind? The elements can tell you nothing, but mind detects a law in the elements that affords a ground for expectation. 29. The appearance silences you semicolon the hint leads you on. And you become, perhaps, a very credulous and unscientific believer, confronted by scientific facts entirely to the contrary. If one is skeptical of the reality of the spiritual world on scientific grounds, or on the score of simple improbability, the best practical advice that can be given him is to transport himself back into early geologic or chemical ages, and then attempt to use a positive philosophy to find out what shall or shall not be, on the ground of appearances. 30. The development of life from nebulous fire is a fact so immensely improbable, that mind cannot be conceived of as accepting it. Take later contrasts, the headless mollusk glued to rock in a world of water, and an antlered deer in a world of verdure, or the huge monster of the prairie, and thinking man. Here are gulfs across which contemporaneous imagination cannot leap. But looking back, you see that they have been crossed, and by a process of orderly development. You see the process and the energy by which it was wrought, but of the source of the process or of the energy, you know nothing until you postulate it. But shut off as you are at every stage of the process from the next, by its improbability, and only able to accept it as you look back upon it, and even then, with an essential unknown factor at work, what right have you, with so confounding a history behind you, to cut it short and close it up with a doubt, on the ground of improbability? 31. You should be prepared to hear the answer of science, that the process under which immortality is claimed, is unlike that of development, that it cannot be gained under the same laws nor according to the same method. Evolution does not spare the individual nor the class. Life, as you see it, is a functional play of something colon art, set in favorable relations to an environment, and ending when the relations become unfavorable. When environment ceases to play well into the organization, and the organization fails to adjust itself to the changing environment, life ends, and the life of that organism cannot go on because it was simply a thing of relations which have been destroyed. 32. This seems logical, and would be final if all the factors and all their processes were embraced and understood in the argument. This, we claim, is not the case, but on the contrary claim that there are factors and elements not recognized, which involves other processes and another history. 33. Science responds, this is all we find. We cannot go outside of the facts and the processes. Life is a functional play of something, we know not what. But not knowing it, we have no right to deal with it, and so set it aside. 34.